curtain was torn from me as he pulled away. And the further he pulled away from me, increasingly the only thing I cared about was that he loved me, and there was nothing I would not have done to be right for him. But although I tried and tried to figure out how I ought to be, my means for judging such a thing seemed to have split off with him. So while Robert seemed to grow finer and more fastidious, easily annoyed by things I said or did, I seemed to grow coarser and more unfocused, and even my athletic tallness, which Robert had admired when we met, with the dissolving of his affection came to feel like an untended sprawl, and my long blonde hair, which I'd been proud of at one time, seemed insipid and childish, just another manifestation of how unequal to Robert I'd proved to be. And after a time, I was overtaken by a paralysis that spread through every area of my life, rapidly, like an illness.
And that's the opening of Flotsam, the opening story from Deborah Eisenberg's new collection, Transactions in a Foreign Currency. Was that story inspired by a memory of yours?
Well, you know, the odd thing is I don't know. I don't think so. I don't really know where that story came from, but it has the feeling of a memory to me, but it isn't really a memory.
For a writer of such talent, you spent so much time not writing. Did you suspect on any level that you were a writer?
Oh, desperately not. I mean, I spent so much time insisting that I wasn't a writer, knowing that I couldn't be a writer, because only writers are writers. So therefore, it was obvious to me that I wasn't a writer.
What were you protesting against? Was anyone arguing that you were a writer?
Well, I guess all my life, various people who were always trying to figure out what on earth I was there for would say from time to time, well, why aren't you writing? You should be writing. But of course, I really think it was that all of my very powerful experiences as a child had been reading experiences. And I do, you know, when I began to write, retroactively, of course, it all seemed very clear to me because I had very intense memories suddenly of reading as a child and thinking, my God, this is magic. Who can do this? Who can make anyone feel the way I feel when I'm reading this?
What was a book that made you feel that way?
Well, I really remember going way back, I mean way back to early childhood and reading, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I remember where I was when I read The Girl of the Limberlost, which of course no one's read for 50 years or something. I remember where I was when I read Caddy Woodlawn. And these were early reading experiences.
Did you feel that something was missing in your life?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't feel anything was actually missing in my life. I just felt that something was missing from me. I felt that I was missing sort of a crucial girder somewhere. I was just a sort of faulty construction. And, you know, I was just sort of condemned to sort of spend my entire life half-built in a way.
When was the first time that you sat down and you wrote fiction or wrote something that wasn't a letter, that wasn't, you know, functional on some other part of your life?
Well, really, I was over 30, and there are a few steps that are almost too amorphous or obscure to even be traced, but basically under the vehement urgings of my boyfriend, and out of complete desperation in my life, I did start to write something that turned into my first story, although it took me years before I knew it was a story.
What was it initially?
I actually thought that I was writing a factual piece about the YMCA, and it seems preposterous to me now, but it is the only story in this collection that is at all autobiographical. And And it is, and it's because it just started out on that basis.
So you realized it was a story, and it took you years, you said, to make it into a story. What did you do to it over those years? Were you changing the character, rewriting sentences, finding new verbs? What were you doing?
Well, partly, I suppose, I was just admitting to myself that I was doing it. And at first, I thought I was keeping a journal. And then, when I finally decided that I was writing something, I wrote it in the past tense. And then, when it became completely apparent that it was completely terrible, which the journal, as a journal, as a sort of false journal, a sort of confected journal, it had not been so terrible, I turned it back into first person, but fictionalized and totally confected sort of thing.
As the story kept changing, did you find yourself having to cut out little flourishes that you'd come to love but which no longer belonged?
Oh, yes, and that is my great pleasure, actually, is cutting. I love to cut. And the better something is, the more I love to cut it, because it's almost a show of strength, which, of course, is of no interest to anyone but me. But really, to just subjugate everything to the final piece of writing is kind of thrilling in a way that I imagine a sporting event is.
I want to ask you to read the beginning of that first story that you wrote that you said is somewhat autobiographical and started off as maybe a journal and then ended up as a story. It's called Days Now.
Right, right. And let me try and find it here. Here it is. I had never known what I was like until I stopped smoking, by which time there was hell to pay for it. When the haze cleared over the charred landscape, the person I had always assumed to be behind the smoke was revealed to be a tinny weights and balances apparatus, rapidly disassembling on contact with oxygen. The first 2 weeks. I lie on the floor and howl with grief. A friend tells me, during the third week, it will occur to you that you're insane, and you'll think, well, now I'm insane. What difference does it make whether I smoke or not? This is a trick to get you to smoke. The third week. I'm insane, but I'm determined to wait it out. Today I bump into someone crossing the street. I begin an apology, but when he tells me to watch where I'm going, in a tone I consider unnecessarily condemning, I seize him by the lapels. For an instant we look at each other, then I release him back into the surge of pedestrians and continue on, stiff with fear. I have gained 20 pounds. I weep unstintingly for the victims of tragedy I see around me on subways, in restaurants, and on the street, but the victims look at me oddly and move away. I find that I have elaborate opinions about things I had never previously given a thought to, and that it is imperative that everyone within earshot understand exactly what I mean and why, in detail, I mean it. Everything makes me angry unless it makes me sad. I cannot tell how long anything takes. Spring. The smoke-free air is a flat, abrasive surface that I must inch my way along, but I'm subject to sudden seizures of pellucid hatred which impel me out the door during dinner or in the early hours of the morning, or, when I'm too helpless to move, into weak, furious storms of tears. Although I'm demanding and insatiable, everything I want is sucked dry of flavor and color and warmth by the time I get it, like packaged foods in an employee cafeteria. When I wake up in the morning, my jaws ache.
It's a great story. It's called Days, and this woman is nearly driven insane, I think, by by having given up smoking. Was your
Absolutely.
Experience somewhat like that?
Oh, it was more than exactly like that.
Were you writing when you stopped smoking?
No,
obviously, because this is your first story.
Yes, and I think actually stopping smoking and starting writing had a great deal to do with each other.
It's interesting because most writers who smoke can't stop because they honestly believe that they will never be able to write another word if they don't have a cigarette.
I actually, not to encourage them in this idea, but But smoking does seem to be lodged into the deepest aspects of one's character. And I think that really, if you stop smoking, you change.
How did you change? By writing?
Well, yes. I mean, in a way, I started to express myself in many ways that I never had before.
My guest is writer Deborah Eisenberg, and her new book of short stories has just been published. It's called Transactions in a Foreign Currency, and it's published by Knopf. I'll say that again so you can understand it. That was Transactions in a Foreign Currency, and it's published by Knopf. When you first started to write, was there anything that threatened to paralyze you that you really had to repress as much as possible, or else it would overcome you and you'd have to stop?
Yeah, I'd say that that is a constant battle, possibly for most writers, certainly for me, that I almost have to write with my eyes closed so that I don't see what I'm writing.
Why is that? Why can't... are you measuring it up against the great writers of our time?
Well, I would say that, sure, inevitably, just as when you read, you measure unless you're really enthralled. But I would say even more that, you know, in a way, one of the things that I hope most to do when I'm writing is to make it look easy. But even as you can see, I don't, you know, words do not fall from my lips in beautiful English cadences. They don't flow from my pen that way either. And really, a first draft of anything I do is appalling. It's just so horrible and so embarrassing. But if you don't get the first draft, you don't get the second draft, and then you don't get the third draft, and you don't get the 200th draft, and you don't get the final draft that looks simple and easy.
Did you tell friends that you were writing?
Oh, no. Only the man I live with, who is himself a writer. I didn't tell anyone, really, for a long, long time.
Did you think that they had some kind of power to take your talent away if they found out?
No, I really didn't think I had any talent, was the problem. And it really is, you're going out on quite a limb when you pick up a pencil, you know. It's a little embarrassing to sort of say, oh, well, I'm sitting down and I'm going to write something. Because actually, if you get even the most sort of garbled humiliation out in the course of a week, you're doing quite well if you're me.
When you started to write, did you start to go to work where you were waitressing with a different attitude?
No. Because when you're waitressing, what's uppermost on your mind is to remember the orders that you've taken and to get them back to the table.
In the modern world, people are usually identified by what it is they do. Uh-huh. And if you're at a party, you are so-and-so who does such-and-such. And if friends introduce you, you're so-and-so who does such-and-such. What was it like for you before you were Deborah Eisenberg, writer, to be introduced as... this is Deborah Eisenberg, she's a waitress? Because the truth is that people's status in the world seems to always be measured by what it is they get paid to do.
That is certainly true here. And I really clung to the title of waitress with a ferocity that that seems now a bit unnecessary, really. I would insist on everyone knowing that I was a waitress and sort of told everyone at the top of my lungs that I was a waitress. And I was a waitress. And actually, I think part of the reason I was so concerned that I'd be known as a waitress when I was introduced was that I, of course, took a certain bitter pleasure in the reaction I would frequently get, which was that the turned back. And also, Well, it was quite interesting to see always what people, how people would react. And also, of course, that's who waitresses are. Waitresses are me. And, you know, I think people should not be rude to their waitress or their taxi driver or whatever. And as they aren't rude to their author.
Well, would people be less interested in you, though, once you proclaimed that you were a waitress?
Oh, very frequently. And then, of course, sometimes it was just considered to be this kind of fascinating and exotic, impossible piece of information, as if there was no such thing as a waitress. How could, I mean, we all know you're not a waitress. There are no waitresses.
Did you go through a period of begrudging your friends their success in the artistic world or anything because you didn't have an outlet like that for yourself?
Well, I would say when I was working as a secretary, which was a job that I was very bad at, with the best will in the world, I was a very, very bad secretary, and I found it extremely difficult, and I hated every moment of it. And at that time, as now, I knew a lot of actors, and I actually, as a group, I prefer actors probably to any other group of people in the world. But I did, you know, when we would all convene in an evening, and my friends would say, oh, we worked so hard today. You know, we did these sensory exercises. The floor was spinach. It was really great work. We worked very hard. And I would think, oh, you worked hard, huh? Yes, I would say that there was a strain of desperate jealousy in my attitude.
In New York, so many of the waiters and waitresses are really painters and actors and actresses and writers and artists, conceptual artists and avant-gardists of one variety or another. Did you eventually come to think of yourself as that, like, well, I'm a waitress, but I'm not really a waitress?
No, and waitressing in a way was a sort of plank that I clung to in a churning sea, and people would say, well, you're not really a waitress. And I would say, well, then what am I doing with this tray? I mean, I really felt that I was really a waitress.
Joseph Papp commissioned you sometime in the early 80s, I guess.
Or possibly late 70s, but I'm afraid I can't. It must have been the early 80s, yeah, or around 1980, yeah.
And what did he ask you to do, to take 5 months on salary to write a play?
Yeah, I was waiting on tables at that time. And, I mean, it seems odd that he would call up a waitress and say, why don't you write a play? And it was a little odd, but it's because this story that I'd written, Days, that I just read the piece of, had been read by a friend of mine at the Public Theater as a reading, and Joe quite liked it. And so he got this idea that maybe I could write a play. And I was afraid to quit my job, waitressing, because it was certainly clear to me that I wasn't going to be able to write a play. So he was very nice, and he said, okay, you know, if you want, keep 2 nights a week work, and I will put you on compensatory salary for, you know, 5 months or so, and write a play.
Was it a hard decision to make to do that?
Well, it wasn't hard in the sense that it wasn't a decision. I mean, I had to. I really couldn't say, oh, no thanks, Joe. I think, no, I'd really much rather just keep waiting on tables and not try to write a play. Because I knew that, even though he was, of course, paying me to do it, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if I really couldn't. It would be pretty bad. It would be a pretty bad thing, but it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if I couldn't do it. And of course, I could always, if it came to him, pay him back. But
so there you were at home, I imagine, yes, Sitting at a table, waiting to write this brilliant play that you were expected to turn out in 5 months. What happened? Did anything come?
Well, waiting is the word. I waited, and I waited, and I waited. And I was simply, I was absolutely terrified. And It's funny, after I write something, I really don't remember what it was like to do it. But I do remember in a way that this play was, it came more easily than anything I've ever written, but it did, I didn't just sit down. I sort of sometimes would get up in the morning and have a drink and wander around the apartment and then sleep for any number of hours. And then after around, I would guess around 2.5 months, I sat down and wrote a play, which simply astonished me and astonishes me now.
And what happened with the play?
Well, it was done at a theater called The Second Stage, and it was quite wonderful. There's nothing like seeing actors take a piece of paper and turn it into real human flesh. It's really incredible.
Now, if I understand correctly, Joseph Papp was not taken with the play.
He was not taken with it. No, I mean...
Did that defeat you?
No, strangely. I can't imagine why not. I really can't imagine why not, but in fact, I quite liked the play. I was quite pleased with it. And in a way, it was, if I hadn't written that play, if Joe hadn't commissioned me to do it, I don't think I would be writing now. And it was, in a way, my way in, really.
So you didn't go back to daytime jobs after that?
No, I kept waitressing until I started selling some of these stories, because, of course, I had to. But by that time, I'd thrown in my lot with writing.
My guest is writer Deborah Eisenberg, and her first collection of short stories has just been published by Knopf. It's called Transactions in a Foreign Currency. During the time you were becoming a writer, you were living with a writer, with Wallace Shawn, who is a playwright and has written a movie. Did you want to show him your work? Did you want, because it's very complicated, I think, when you're living with someone who does something like what you do, about how much you want to commiserate on that thing.
Yes, although also I would say that if I hadn't been living with a writer, or perhaps if I hadn't been living with this particular writer, I also wouldn't have dared write, and probably not dared to continue. And there have been times when I've been more or less dependent on showing him things. I've never shown anyone, including him, anything sort of at the beginning. Not till I'm really quite far along, according to me, in something. But it was terribly helpful at first when, you know, it was evident to me that I was not a writer and could not be a writer because I couldn't write. I simply couldn't get anything into English. And he said, well, of course you can't. He said, everybody writes like a five-legged pig at first, was his great phrase. And I think that that's true for most writers. And I think that only another experienced writer would have known that or had the generosity to let me in on that secret.
Did you ever fear that you'd feel dwarfed, you know, having this already acclaimed writer in the house looking at your stuff and you were still a fledgling writer?
Strangely, I don't remember ever having felt like that. I don't know why not, but I've now run into quite a few writers that I admire enormously, deeply, deeply respect, and I can't do any of the things that they can do, and yet somehow in a way I feel that they have a respect for what I'm doing and a sympathy for it that no one can have unless they've sort of gone through some of the same technical problems themselves.
One other fear.
Yes, oh yes. Fear.
How New about fears, this one? Oh boy. did you ever think that if your editor or mentor or whatever is your lover, that there's a certain unequalness that's suddenly injected into the relationship that you can fear might carry over into other parts of the relationship?
Well, I would say that would have been more of a problem before I started writing, because I don't really know how to put this, but writing itself is a way of it's a way of maintaining one's privacy. It's a way of, just as there are no two people alike, there are no two writers alike. And you don't, there's no question of blurred distinctions when it comes down to the page, as there is in real life. And really, when you've got that page there in front of you, everything else falls away. It's a very powerful thing.
Did you want to try to take advantage of context that he might have that you might be able to use?
Well, I certainly would have, except that none of them really were very useful to me. I mean, really, now it's wonderful to know writers that he knows and to know all kinds of people that he knows. But it's, you know, when you're submitting things to be accepted, say, in a publication as I was, it really doesn't matter who you know at all, because there's so many good writers, and nobody cares who you know. They care how you write, I think. I mean, perhaps this is a self-serving view. And actually, to tell you the truth, the contact that I found my publisher as a waitress. I was basically discovered in a bar.
How?
Well, I was working in this bar where I worked, and I would wait on this very nice couple from time to time. And the woman said, she kept saying to me, "Well, you're a writer, aren't you?" And I kept saying, "No, I'm a waitress." And she'd say, no, you're a writer. I know you're a writer." And I'd say, "No, I'm a waitress." And it turned out she was a writer, and her name is Lori Colwyn. I'm sure you are familiar with her writing. And then my play was done, and she said, "Aha, you see, you are a writer. Why don't you show me something that you've written?" So I did, and the next day, a friend of hers, who is now my editor at Knopf, called me. And that was how I got published initially.
That's a great story.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was just wonderful. I mean, I had stories in magazines between then and the time my book came out, but that was my first publishing contact, really.
Was your life really changed by that? Did you feel like a different person and, you know, charting out a different course for your life?
Well, I'd love to say no, of course, but the truth is, yes, I feel very, very different. It's just wonderful to... I really love writing, and I really love being a writer. I love it.
My guest is writer Deborah Eisenberg, and her new book, Transactions in a Foreign Currency, has 7 of her short stories that's just been published by Knopf. Now, some people might have felt that they knew you or knew of you already through My Dinner with Andre before your book came out, because you're mentioned in there several times. How did that affect you at all when the movie came out and when more people felt this connection with you from having seen the movie? And so you were being seen basically through somebody else's eyes.
It was really quite nice because in a way it's the nicest role I think a woman has ever had in a movie, even though I wasn't exactly in the movie. It really, it's a very honorable position, my position in that movie, and it was very gratifying. Yeah,
a lot of your short stories are about losing your bearings because of change and of being disoriented, and things eventually kind of clear up in the stories, but you never really know what's going to happen. Is that a preoccupation of yours?
Well, I wouldn't know. I mean, I don't suppose one does know what one's own preoccupations are. And in fact, you reading the book are in a much better position to know that than I am as the writer.
And your writer, well, I'll ask you this anyways, that your characters also frequently see themselves as outsiders, and they're looking into the lives of other people and are kind of interested in their lives, which usually seem more organized and more fulfilling and more completed than their own. Does that describe a reaction you've had?
Oh, sure. That definitely rings a bell. Certainly more organized lives. Yes.
What kind of family background are you from?
Well, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and my extremely nice father is a pediatrician, and my mother is what I guess used to be described as a housewife, and I have an older brother. Now you know everything about it.
You never really studied writing when you were in school, right?
No.
Well, why not?
Well, first of all, because I knew, as I said, that I wasn't a writer. And, you know, I'm really quite, even though this is not to disparage writing courses, because clearly people can get an enormous amount out of them, and perhaps they're just the thing for many people to do. But as for myself, I'm quite glad that I never studied writing.
What do you think it would have given you inhibitions that you would have had to overcome?
Well, I think mainly, of course, one of the big dangers of writing is that naturally you're using your ear quite a bit if you're a writer, and it's very easy to be a sort of flypaper for other people's styles, and one desperately, desperately wants to avoid that and find out. Part of course, of the fun of writing is discovering the writer that you yourself are. And in a way, although, of course, I'd love to have a much more comfortable relationship to a lot of techniques that are required just to do anything, I'm glad not to sort of have a set pattern in which I do things, because it's nice to have this sort of roaring beast in a cage that you unlock when you sit down. And it just, the way that it sort of comes at you is very, very valuable, I think.
How old were you when you moved to New York?
Oh, I must have been around 20, I guess.
Was that a big experience in your life?
Oh, I couldn't wait to get to New York, really. At least as I remember it, my whole life, in a way, I couldn't wait to get to New York. I loved it, and I do love it, even though it's difficult.
Was that an opportunity for you to make changes that you in yourself, to reveal things about yourself that you'd been wanting to, but that you were too inhibited by other circumstances to do? Would you think you were freed up by moving to New York in any way?
Well, I think that's part of the thing that draws anyone to New York is the possibility of complete anonymity. And coming from a suburb, that must have been a very, very strong pull for me. But I would say that for quite some time, the experience of just doing the things that you have to do every day in New York to get from one bit of it to another were all I could handle. And it was a long time until I was able to have any sort of experience at all other than just basic maintenance ones.
I'm going to ask you to do another reading
for
one of your stories. And this is from a story called Rafe's Coat. And let me see. How about the section that starts on page 76?
Okay.
Is that the section I mean? Yes.
Got it. I must admit, I wasn't having just the greatest time with men. I was finding that you have to get to know someone a bit in order to become interested in getting to know him at all. And that was such a bore. The same questions, the same little conversations over and over. Were you close to your father? Just think, so you too, as a child, were afraid of getting hit by the baseball. Tell me, do you really believe that it's possible to rid oneself of unconscious concerns over fuel costs when discussing our Middle Eastern policies, and so on and so forth, just like having to slog through those statistic courses in college before being allowed to register for abnormal personality? I did go out now and again, of course, but in a perfunctory frog-kissing sort of spirit, and a frog, in my experience, is a frog to the finish. My own love life at that time, then, provided me with no information to sort through, nothing to think about or try to get in order. It was as useful to the production of conversation as disappearing ink is to the production of literature, and so I began to tap, for all it was worth, that skill which one develops during adolescence, of turning to account the love lives of one's friends. And since, among my friends, Rafe had always tended to have the most multiform and highly colored love life, I looked forward most to seeing him. Sadly, though, he'd become quite uncooperative since he'd taken up with Heather. He rarely put in an appearance, and when he did, he just sat around lumpishly and quaffed down great quantities of my expensive scotch.
The story that you just read an excerpt of, Rafe's coat, is told first person by a wealthy woman who works for an endowment and gives out a lot of money to artists. And there's some really wonderfully funny dialogue and interior monologue in there. And it just really made me wonder how you got the ear for that, because there are so many different kinds of characters that you write about, and I wonder, you know, have you been eavesdropping a lot? Or
not consciously. In fact, I'm not a very good eavesdropper. In restaurants, I'm a total failure as an eavesdropper.
People can tell you're listening in?
I can't get the sounds clear. Just too much interference from other tables and that sort of thing. No, I've never... You know, I don't carry around a little notebook, and I don't sort of think, this is interesting, I'd better remember it. I really don't know where these people in this story came from. I mean, that's what one hopes one sort of hears the sounds that the world is making, and that's the best one can do, I think, is hope.
There's one other passage I'm going to ask you to read, and that's it's a dream, basically, in that first story that you wrote that we were talking about that started off as a journal, and that's about someone who's giving up smoking. And the dream is, I think, on page 142, I think.
Oops.
And this is from Transactions in a Foreign Currency. Do I have the page
yes.
right on it?
Okay. Yes, you do.
I'd like you to read the dream, and I've had this dream, which is why I want you to read it.
I'm sorry. My dream. This is a dream I frequently have. I glance down at my hand. The posture I've denied it for so long, the gesture it has so often hopelessly initiated, is suddenly deliciously completed. I am holding a lit cigarette. I am now able, I reason in my dream, to display the scope of my will. I can either inhale from the cigarette in my hand or not, as I freely choose. I freely choose to inhale, and the fantasy instantly collapses. The entire mendacious simulacrum shivers and falls at my feet, leaving me, a slave who will have to smoke forever now, in the barren waking world where it is easy to recognize the dreadful thing I had briefly mistaken for choice. Then I wake truly, empty-handed in the merciful morning.
I've really had that dream, have you?
I really have. I'm just horrified to find out that you... Are you an ex-smoker?
Yeah, I stopped around probably 7 years ago, and I have that dream, I'd say, between every 4 and 7 months.
Yes, I still have it. I don't know how frequently, but at the beginning I had it all the time, and I still have it.
I love the way you say it. that you confused it with choice or however you put it.
Isn't that just the way it is, really, in that dream? You think, oh, well, you know, I don't have to do this any longer.
And you realize you're a slave.
Yeah.
Do people tell you that they recognize themselves in any of your stories? And if so, is that important? I mean, is that good? Does it matter?
I would be extremely pleased to hear such a thing. No one has said exactly that to me. They've said, I recognize people that I know. I recognize it seemed real to me. It was just the way it is. No one has said, oh, that's me. Although, believe me, anyone wants to tell me that, I'll be thrilled to hear it.
Now that you are a writer, do you want to be a part of writer circles and go to writer's parties? Because there are all these scenes, especially in places like New York, which is the heart of the publishing industry.
Yeah, I gather that that's true. No, I don't sort of have a particular interest in being sort of socially a writer. I love talking to other writers. I love meeting other writers because it is this kind of little thing that people understand what other people are doing as readers of other people's writings. It's quite exciting. I mean, I feel that it's really as well. It's hard to say exactly what it is, but praise from another writer means an enormous amount to me. And in a way, I feel that I'm the best reader ever born. I so often feel, well, I mean, this is my one talent. This is what I can do. And I so often feel, oh, this was written for me. This was written for me. In no one else's mind does this live in such vivid detail and such depth.
What are some recent books that made you feel that way?
Oh, recent book. Well, I can tell you, what have I been reading this week? Maybe that's what I should.
Fine.
Because I'm not. I haven't really read so much since I've been writing, but this week I happen to have been reading quite a bit, and I've been very slowly reading Paradise Lost, which I'm sure everyone feels that way about. This is for me. And I also read cover to cover David Levitt's collection, Family Dancing, which I'd never really read cover to cover before. And I mean, I just thought, I am the person that this was written for. And I also read A Perfect Spy, which is the John le Carré book that everyone else has read this week. And it's just marvelous. It's just thrilling. I spent two wonderful days with it this week.
Are you satisfied with the short story form?
Well, I don't really know, and I'm not sure I even use it. I think there would be people who say that these fictions of mine are not exactly short stories, although I don't know what...
Well, what would disqualify them from the short story category?
I don't really know, because I don't know, not having studied writing and not having studied literature, I don't really know what a short story is supposed to be. But I would say I love reading short stories. I've always, in a way, preferred reading short stories to reading other things for reasons that I can hardly even grasp myself. But as far as writing goes, I just have written things in whatever way they seem to want to be written. And they've turned out to be things of this length.
When we were setting up this interview, you told me on the phone that you used to be lazy, that you used to think you didn't want to do anything.
Right.
You were happy to not do anything.
I sure did think that. And I still am. I'm the laziest person you have ever met. I mean,
Give me some proof.
Well, I really hate to do almost anything that would be considered work. Although I really quite, I mean, if writing is too hard for me, it's too hard for me to do, but I don't consider it work exactly. It's a sort of deep, difficult pleasure. But no, I mean, if I as I may soon have to do, earn a living again. I just don't know what I'll do. I mean, I'd almost prefer to just lie on the street and, you know, with a tin cup. I really hate earning a living. And I don't like cross-country skiing, and I don't like cooking, and I don't like doing all kinds of things that people do.
As gratifying as writing seems to be to you, do you ever wish that you could stop thinking about sentences that were hanging you up? Or, you know, I mean, are you haunted now, although, you know, gratifying as it is? Are there times that you would really like to turn it off and forget about
the
whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, when I can't do anything very good, I mean, right now I'm just as stuck as anyone ever has been. And also, I don't ever know whether I'll ever be able to do anything again. And this could be the end. I mean, you may be talking to an ex-writer. but it's true that I mean, one other great thing that my boyfriend said to me when I was writing, you know, when I started, I said, well, how on earth can you think of, you know, that I would be able to write? I've never done anything in my whole life. I've never done anything useful, and I really can't do any kind of work, and I'm just totally useless. And he said, well, that's one of the wonderful things about being a writer, because when you're a writer, everything that you do can be considered work. But of course, now I'm coming to see the other side of the coin, which is that, in a way, everything you do can be considered work, and there's no time at which, you know, you can't sort of come home from the office and kick off your shoes and pour yourself a martini and turn on the TV, because there's no time at which life stops. And that's what you're doing, in a way, I think what a writer is doing is sort of engaging in life, even if only inside four walls.
It must be very exciting for you to have a book now, to have everything collected in a cover. And
oh, I tell you, everything collected in a cover, a physical object. I simply love it.
Well, I love your writing, and it's really been a pleasure to have you here. And I want to thank you very, very much
thank
for coming
you.
And talking and doing some reading for us. Thanks a lot for
thank
being
you.
Here. My guest has been New York-based writer Deborah Eisenberg, and her new book of short stories, which she read a few excerpts from, is called Transactions in a Foreign Currency, and it's published by Knopf, the name again, Transactions in a Foreign Currency. And it features seven of her stories, four of which were initially published in The New Yorker magazine. Well, it's 5 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We'll be joining National Public Radio for All Things Considered at 5 o'clock. And this evening on All Things Considered, they will have a report on the anniversary of the Soweto Uprising in South Africa. So you can stay tuned for that at 5 o'clock. And that, of course, will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. Well, every Monday on Fresh Air through the end of June, we're featuring the series Marian McPartland's Piano Jazz, and each week, jazz pianist Marian McPartland is joined by a guest pianist for duets and conversation. Her guest today is pianist Nellie Lutcher.
The following program is made possible by a grant from Exxon Corporation. From Los Angeles, this is Marian McPartland's Piano Jazz, a colorful kaleidoscope of great keyboard artists from the world of jazz, hosted by talented composer-pianist Marian McPartland. For her guest today, Marian welcomes the remarkable composer, pianist, and vocalist, a real gone gal, Nellie Lutcher.
You're a living legend. Do you know that?
And I didn't know that.
Well,
yet.
You sure are. And it's just so great to see you. I'm trying. I don't know when the last time was, but it was quite.
I think in New York in 1980.
At the cookery.
At the cookery, yeah. That's the last time I saw you. It's the last time I was in New York.
And Bonnie Josephson had brought you back, which was so wonderful to see you. You know, before that, I think the last time I might have, I seem to remember catching you in a club in Rochester, New York, But that goes back
a long time.
How are you?
It all happened a long time ago.
You just look wonderful. Well, I've got to ask you a few things that I guess not everybody knows. Like, you made such a sensation with your records. And I had come over from England. I hadn't been in this country too long. And Jimmy and I were living at Jimmy McPartland, you know, and I would. He sent his love to you, by the way.
Well, give him mine, too.
And we were living in Chicago. And I used to listen to Dave Garraway's show all the time. And he played your records incessantly.
He did.
I mean, he really helped you, didn't he?
He really did. He was very, very kind to me.
Well, we were working a real dive at the time. We were working the Brass Rail. And
in the loop.
In the loop, yes. We used to